we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
Right. Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they sent 68 souls worth of food. That's for six people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
In case that didn't sound familiar, it's from the movie The Martian. Matt Damon plays an astronaut and botanist who gets stuck on Mars, long story, and he has to figure out a way to grow enough food to feed himself until the next mission to Mars arrives in a few years' time. If you haven't seen it, it's not really a spoiler to say that Mars does come to fear his botany powers. And then, of course, there's a parallel plotline about coming back to rescue him. Actually, quick tangent here. It turns out that if you look back over Matt Damon's filmography, he has had to be rescued a lot. Someone even sat down a few years ago and calculated approximately how much fictional money has been spent rescuing Matt Damon. In Saving Private Ryan, for example, the search party sent into World War II Europe would probably have cost about $100,000, they say. Syriana, $50,000. Courage Under Fire, $300,000. There are a bunch more movies. I've only heard of about half of them. But of course, the costs spike a bit with the space movies he's in. Interstellar, they reckon $500 billion. In The Martian, it's a much more modest $200 billion. So the total amount spent attempting to bring Matt Damon back from distant places, $900 billion plus change. I guess this is how much we love Matt Damon. Anyway, The Martian, great movie. Not being a scientist or an engineer myself, I was pretty untroubled by the question of how accurate either his botany or the space travel stuff in it really was. But recently, I was at a science and faith conference run by ISCAST, a group of Christian scientists, and I got to speak with a couple of people who think about these kinds of practical realities all the time. Later, you'll hear from Jonathan Clark, an Australian who's been on a mission to Mars. Well, sort of. It was a Mars simulation, so he was still on Earth, but essentially it's a dress rehearsal for when they eventually do send a manned mission to Mars. As close as you can get to the real deal for now. But first, here's James Garth. He is an aerospace engineer who says that getting people to Mars really is just the next step in space exploration and could happen, is even very likely to happen, within our lifetime. For starters, I wanted to know, what exactly does an aerospace engineer do?
I get to play with big boys' toys every day. My main job is to make sure the wings don't fall off. If the wing falls off, it's a bad day. If the wing stays on, it's a good day.
Does the wing fall off a lot?
It tends to not fall off, although we design it so it only just doesn't fall off because it needs to be light enough to get off the ground. So you're flying around in things that only just work.
So the wings of what are we talking about?
Commercial airliners, yeah.
Okay.
So we've got this method down pat. You don't have to worry about anything, but aerospace is a really demanding profession because you're pushing yourself up against the extremes of what is actually possible. You've got to shave out weight at every opportunity. You've got to constantly innovate and use new materials, new technologies. And that's why I actually love doing aerospace engineering. It's just a really fun and challenging pursuit.
Tell me where you think we're at in terms of space travel.
Well, right at the moment, we're going through an interesting phase of commercialization of space exploration. So you've got companies like SpaceX and what Elon Musk is doing, working in the private sector, albeit with a lot of government-backed funding, to try and commercialize space. You've also got mainstream outfits like NASA and the equivalent Russian and Chinese organizations more formally pursuing their own programs. The real target for the next few decades will be Mars and actually getting people to set foot on Mars. So we've explored a lot of our solar system with probes. We've sent probes to the the inner planets and the outer planets, including Pluto, as you would have seen in the last couple of years. And I think we've got to that point where we know what's sort of going on within our own local area. But in terms of getting people out there, that's the next big step.
It's clear that James really likes his job and really likes space. This was true from a pretty young age for him. He told me about seeing an ad in a magazine years ago. Actually, he can't remember what the ad was for, but the effect it had on him has stayed with him.
So one of my formative experiences was as a young, budding aero engineer reading through a copy of Aviation Week and seeing on the back cover a full-page ad saying, "In 200 years, spaceflight will be routine. You, however, will be dead." And I looked at this, to this day, I can't remember what it was advertising. It might have been aviation insurance or something, I don't know, because I was too busy trying to pick myself off the floor from this existential crisis that had been induced by this ad. I realised that for all these wonderful technologies, for all these incredible achievements that you see, you know, rockets that can be reused and drones that can fly long missions and amazing stuff, every discovery by the Hubble or the Kepler, there's this realization that at the bottom, when all the really, really good stuff comes along, I'm going to be dead.
Now, you think that worldview matters in how we think about space exploration and space colonization, if we call it that. What impact do people's worldviews have on how they think about this?
I think when you look at something that's so grand as space exploration, the prism through which you look, the worldview through which you view space exploration has an impact in whether you see the whole thing as being an exercise that is kind of melancholy and futile, or whether it's something that's maybe building up to something grander. And I think, honestly, on the religious side of things, we're maybe a little bit slow to the party here. I think there's a really interesting theological aspect to exploring the cosmos.
When it comes to the big questions about space exploration, like whether we should actually do it, and if we do, how we should go about it, James's Christian worldview has a lot to do with how he thinks about this stuff.
I hold to the view that the meaning of life is to bring glory to God by enjoying him forever. Now, what does enjoying God mean? Well, it means appreciating all of the wondrous variety, both of this world and in the worlds beyond ours. And I think we glorify God by how we enjoy his creation. And this feeds into other things like creation care, how we care for our earth and are good stewards for it. This should also apply as we move forward in the cosmos. We should move forward with respect and valuing and bringing order and stewardship to these other worlds.
What does your faith do for your existential angst that you were telling us about?
It means that I can't put all of my eggs in the basket of wanting to be satisfied in this life here and now. That's just not achievable. I also think if we were to go down the path of, say, the transhumanists trying to modify ourselves so that we can live for extraordinary long lifespans and that sort of thing, I'm worried that the corruptibility of human nature will come to the fore and we'll realise that we'll get ourselves in a very bad situation if we pursue that path without constraints. My faith gives me hope that the seeds that we plant in this life will grow and become trees that we can enjoy and explore in the next life.
How do you imagine that?
Well, I think to quote Martin Luther, he was once asked, what would you do if you knew that Jesus was returning tomorrow? And he said, plant a tree. Mm-hmm. And I just love that because it's showing that while there's discontinuity between this life and the next life, obviously we must be brought back in some form by the Creator. The things that we do carry on and live on. And I'm thinking of intangible things too, like friendship, art, music. Okay, so I see a place for these things in the new creation that is coming.
So do you think these beliefs impact how you do your work and how you kind of approach this whole business of, you know, humans should push forward?
It's a challenge for those of us who want to see the fruits of our labour, and we're working on things that can be so vast they will outlive our own mortal lives. I think the idea of a new heaven and new earth, a restored and redeemed cosmos, gives me some hope that, like, all this toil is not for naught.
I mean, it was inevitable that chatting to an aerospace engineer, we would turn to sci-fi sooner or later. I had a lot of questions. Take Interstellar, for example.
So they say you want to go from here to there, but it's too far, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a wormhole bends space like this, so you can take a shortcut through a higher dimension. To show that, they've turned three-dimensional space into two dimensions, which turns a wormhole into two dimensions, a circle. What's a circle in three dimensions?
Sphere.
Exactly. A spherical hole.
But who put it there? Who do we have to thank?
Well, I'm not thanking anybody until we get out of here in one piece, Rom.
It's got wormholes, time travel, five-dimensional universes. It's hectic. What is going on in this film? But one thing that the clip touches on is this idea that a lot of modern science fiction assumes that there is no higher power. Matthew McConaughey's character isn't going to thank anyone or anything for this wormhole that's appeared that's going to lead him and his fellow space traveller to safety.
If we're honest, we would say that the canvas upon which modern science fiction is painted is often a naturalistic canvas, insofar as they don't invoke supernatural causes or they don't refer to God or gods in any major way. They will look at themes like mortality and ethics and artificial intelligence. Things like Blade Runner 2049 really delved into those things deeply. And they're not always critical of religions per se, but they kind of assume that there's no one really in control of the show.
Is it also a question of kind of human self-sufficiency? We have us, and that's all we have.
Well, yeah, this was the thing of Interstellar, right? A bit of a spoiler alert. At the end, yep. Highly evolved humans help out earlier humans by creating portals and wormholes and other cool things.
So are there more theistic versions of this kind of, literature or film? How do you imagine that panning out?
There are movies and series that kind of venture into that territory. They dip their toes in, like Avatar might be a very interesting one. In this you see what is effect, another spoiler, but the resurrection of the dead at the end. Okay, this character, gets a new body and he explores this new world, and it's really interesting. And you can think about that and go, oh, okay, that might make ideas like resurrection come alive more to you after seeing that. And C.S. Lewis also wrote a space trilogy where he had the Earth as a fallen world and all the other worlds didn't fall to the same degree as mankind. And you think, oh, maybe there are other worlds that have the same moral dilemmas as we have, but maybe they haven't fallen as far, or maybe their plan of redemption is different. So I think there's a lot of really interesting sci-fi ideas that could be explored within a less naturalistic lens and still be really interesting.
Scientists and engineers, I don't know if you'll think this is fair, but they can have a reputation for favouring function over beauty. What role do you think beauty has in doing science, and maybe especially space science?
I think you're right that we tend to be functionalists as engineers, although one of the greatest aeronautical engineers of all time was Kelly Johnson from the Lockheed Skunk Works. And he said that if a plane looks ugly, it will fly ugly. So beauty was actually, for him, a key to the aerodynamic and airworthiness of the aircraft. And so I think there's actually a little bit of wisdom still in Kelly Johnson's thoughts. But I think beauty is something that I think we all recognise, whether we're a theist or a naturalist or from whatever background, we know it when we see it. And what I want to challenge people to do is think, how does their worldview treat beauty? Is it something we can enjoy but ultimately will get crushed out by the burning sun in a few billion years time, or the heat death of the universe? So beauty is transient, but and maybe even beauty is illusory ultimately. It might be so subjective. Or do we see beauty as something that is a pointer to something more? Are we meant to follow the clues? What are these things saying about our world?
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Is there life on Mars? Okay, so David Bowie's song has nothing to do with life on Mars. For the record, the TV show Life on Mars, also completely unrelated to space travel, just to preempt any disappointment there. Of course, the actual question, is there life on Mars, has long been asked by humans. And if the scientists I spoke to at this conference are right, even if there never has been before, the plan is that there will be in the future.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Clark. I am an astrogeologist.
Gotta say, I didn't know that astrogeology was a thing until I met Jonathan Clark. It's a pretty cool title, really topped only by the fact that he is also the president of the Mars Society Australia, which I also didn't know was a thing until this conversation.
The Mars Society Australia is an organisation that works towards the human presence on Mars. And so we do public outreach about space exploration, about the significance of exploring Mars, going to Mars for human future. And we also work towards Australia actually getting a space program, because we're one of only two countries in the OECD which doesn't have one.
Oops.
Whoops, indeed. It's very embarrassing when Angola and Laos have a bigger space civil space program than Australia.
Going to Mars in the future, one of the goals of Mars societies all around the world, will take a lot of preparation and planning and practice. In fact, there have been several missions to Mars simulated here on Earth to really nut out the details, what works, what doesn't, who we might want to send. And as it happens, John Clark is one of those people.
Yes, in 2016 and 2017, I was very privileged to be part of the Mars 160 program. So this was a project of the US Mars Society, which is a sister organization, to carry out two very similar expeditions, twin missions, in their station in Utah and their station in the Canadian Arctic on Devon Island. And we would spend ideally 80 days at each location simulating a Mars mission. We would use essentially the same facility, because these are twin stations. We would have the same crew, or almost the same crew, and we'd be doing similar work. But in one, we'd be working in a cold desert environment in the Canadian Arctic, and the other is in a hot desert environment in Utah. Although, let me tell you, Utah in winter is a lot colder than the Canadian Arctic in summer.
So why these two particular places? How do they map in terms of being Mars-like?
Both these areas are what we call Mars analogues. They have features on them that are similar to Mars in some respects. So in the Canadian Arctic, the ground is frozen. There's permafrost. We know there's permafrost in Mars. The station is on the edge of the Horton impact crater, which is a 20-kilometre in diameter impact crater blasted into the Canadian Arctic by an asteroid hitting the Earth 35 million years ago or so. In Utah, you've got a red, dry desert with rocks that are full of clays, full of sulfates, just like we see on Mars. So although it's not a cold desert, you know, it's a hot desert, there are geological similarities which we can study, and the Canadian Arctic, we can look at the cold desert aspects. And together, looking at these two different environments and the processes operating and their signature in the environment helps us understand Martian processes and how we go about studying them. Because when we go there to study, we're living in a habitat, a tuna can, we call it, 8 metres high, 8 metres in diameter, two decks. There were seven of us in Utah, six in the Arctic, and we don't go outside for operational reasons without wearing a simulator spacesuit. So if you want to go outside to look at some rocks or study some bacteria, you put on the suit, you set up your communications network, you sit in the airlock for 5 minutes to depressurize, as it were, then you go out and do your work, and then you reverse all of that to come back inside. So you don't just sort of, you know, duck outside for a smoke, if any of us smoked, which none of us did, or just to enjoy the view. It's a serious event, just like being on Mars. Going outside would be a serious event.
So do you get a bit stir crazy? You're there for weeks and weeks and you can't go outside without putting on a spacesuit, and you're with these same seven or eight people.
you're too busy. I mean, people ask questions like that all the time. What do you do all the time? And it's sort of the expectation you sit there looking at each other, waiting for someone to pick their nose and then you can tear them to shreds. But you're working 12, 13-hour days, 6 days a week. You're planning your next EVA. You are doing the EVA, your extravehicular activity. You are working up the results. You're supporting other people as they go out. There's cooking and cleaning. There's burning your toilet waste. As we say, the crew, the poos together, stays together. So you do all your business in plastic bags and you put it in an incinerator every couple of days and you burn it. I mean,
that was going to be one of my questions.
Yeah, it's going to be, you are very good friends after all of this.
Yeah.
And they were great. I mean, I'd do it again with that crew. I mean, they were really, really nice people. I mean, we're all very different. We had someone from India, two Australians, a Canadian, an American, a Russian, and a Frenchman. So we're an international crew, very different backgrounds, different ages, but we all worked really well together. They're more family than friends now.
And they have different skills.
Very much so.
What were their specialisms, and are those the kinds of people that we would actually take to Mars?
Yes, we had two geologists. We had a biologist, and several engineers. Some of them were aerospace engineers. We had a journalist who's also an aerospace engineer student. She's studying to be a cosmonaut in Russia. And we also had an artist on board who's also a communications person. So she was very, very good in terms of, because we spent a lot of time writing reports. So you can't escape paperwork, even on Mars. So she was really good as a professional communicator to make sure that what we said made sense and was concise and so on.
Do you ever get so immersed in the mission that you kind of forget that you're not on Mars?
It's a role play. Mm-hmm. And for practical purposes, you know, the more you get into that mindset, you know, the more you get out of it and the more valuable it is. But so, yes, the first time we went outside at the end of the simulations of, ooh, we're going outside, not wearing a spacesuit. But it is a role play. So in an emergency, you can drop that very quickly and go and do what you do. And so, for example, in the Arctic, we'd send two people out on an extravehicular activity, but we'd always have a third person out there who wasn't wearing a spacesuit, and they were carrying a shotgun because there's big white furry things in the Arctic that might eat you. It won't be those on Mars. But, yeah, we always had someone on polar bear.
So far as we know.
As far as we know. So we always had someone on polar bear duty. And I had to go through all the training here in Australia, so I'm known to the federal police as the polar bear guy. Because why do you want to use a pump-action shotgun, which is not an easy weapon to get a license for in Australia? Well, polar bears. And so, oh, yeah, you better write it up. So I wrote this sort of 5-page document and they had a good laugh over it. And,
yeah, it doesn't sound like the most convincing story. So I'm kind of going to Mars and there might be polar bears.
Yeah, that's right.
So what did you learn from these expeditions that might help us when or if we go to Mars?
Well, I think we showed that a well-selected crew, people who knew each other, who were committed to working together, who respected each other's differences, could do a very, very successful expedition under many of the conditions that we have on Mars. We knew this already, but it's just good to reinforce that. We got an idea of how much time we could actually spend exploring Mars. When we worked out that you could probably do an EVA, an extravehicular activity, probably at least two, perhaps three per person per week. So you'd have a crew outside with six people on the surface of Mars every day during a six-day week. That's the other thing. Yeah, we need a day off every week. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just get too ratty. You need that time to relax and read a book and sleep in. And I mean, you'd do a few things. You'd write your diary and, you know, the housework would continue. But just take it easy. Yeah, mm-hmm. 6 days is your labour. It's very true, even on Mars.
Yeah. Can you tell me about a time when things either went wrong or when there were particular triumphs that you remember?
I think probably the biggest challenge was getting to the station in the Arctic, which hadn't been used for about 6 years. And we got there and the previous people had left it in a horrible mess. It was just full of junk. there was mold everywhere. I mean, I'm surprised it didn't sort of leap off the walls or grab us by the throat. I mean, mold millimetres thick covering cupboards, you know, cans of food that had exploded and then sort of had this primordial slime. And we had to clean it up. We had to clean up before we got to bed. We had to sort of scrub out our sleeping areas because there was mold there. But within 3 days, we had the place in a good enough shape to be ready to carry out the mission. And we fought the mold for the remaining month that we were there. But we kept it under control. I actually had a dream one night where the Indian girl in our expedition had really, really long hair. You know, she'd just about sit on it. And I actually dreamt one night that she got mold all the way through her hair. We had to sort of shave it all off. She didn't think that was quite so funny when I told her in the morning. But, yeah, and this actually happens on real space missions. Some of the early space stations did fight huge battles with mold until, you know, technologies were developed to deal with it.
What was your most memorable EVA?
Oh, I think that one of them, we went about 15 kilometres away from the station riding quad bikes. You know, along this shallow gravel bed river. Because the thing with the Arctic, although it's a cold desert, is actually there's mud everywhere. So the best way to get around is actually to drive down the creek beds, which are full of coarse gravel. We drove around and just the scale of the interior of this impact crater and all of these shattered rocks and impact melts. And you'd very easily imagine yourself on an alien planet because there were sort of, you know, strange greys and yellows and oranges. So that was an extraordinary experience.
So what's it like wearing a spacesuit?
Wearing a spacesuit is a very interesting experience because these are simulated spacesuits, which is a fancy way of saying they're costumes. I mean, they are quite primitive. I mean, they're essentially overalls with some extra stiffening. You wear heavy boots and heavy gloves. You have a helmet that's made out of partly out of a rubbish bin lid and a plastic bubble. And you wear a hobby box on your back that's got batteries and fans through corrugated swimming pool hose to keep air to the helmet. And you put this on, and suddenly you're actually isolated from the external world. You know, you can't, if you touch something, you can't really feel it. You always want to say, I'm going to take the gloves off and do it properly. But no, that's not in the simulation. You can't, I mean, geologists have this strange habit of licking rocks to sort of see what they look like. You can't do that. You know, sometimes the rock's got dust on, you pick it up and you blow on it, and suddenly you realize, no, you can't blow on it because there's this bubble on your head. You're isolated from the environment too. When you go out for a bushwalk, you feel the breeze on your face, the wind in your hair. When you're inside this bubble, you don't feel it. You can hear the wind, but you don't feel it. And you're in this, it's like being in this tiny little personal capsule, which can become cozy because if it's -5 degrees outside in the Utah winter at midday, it's nice having a little warm, cozy bubble. But you're also working hard because the backpack weighs, in the case of one in Utah, 17 kilos. You're lugging around a lot of weight. Your boots might be a kilo each. You no longer just saunter around. You actually got to think every time where you put your step. Now, with care, you can get most places. We always think, no, should I go up that hill? What if I fall? Mm. You know, it's not going to be very nice falling wearing this gear. You know, smash your teeth, break your nose, you break your leg, injure your back. So you've got to plan everything you do ahead of time and take your time. But a strange thing is we did do comparative trials working in the same area, doing the same works in both locations, without the suits on and with the suits on. And curiously enough, when you're wearing the suit, it forces you to focus. You become more aware and you actually work, oddly enough, you observe more efficiently than you do if you're just sort of walking around in your shorts and T-shirt. It's a curious experience. Of course, if you're doing mechanical work and we erected a dome, it's extremely hard, you know, doing all this fine manipulation with tools and so on. And that was really quite tough.
Did you experience any reverse culture shock when you came back?
Oh, yes. Yes. Particularly coming back from Utah, at the end of the mission, we had to drive to Grand Junction. It's actually in Colorado to pick up an extra vehicle for us to leave. And, of course, we went and had a meal in a proper restaurant and we had steak and fresh salad. And it just... I don't know how good it really was, but it just tasted so good. I think seeing how much stuff people use, because we're living in close quarters and you go into an ordinary house and there's space everywhere and you're not sort of trying to account for every drop of water you use. I mean, you turn the tap on and it comes out at high pressure rather than sort of dribbling out. I mean, just how much water you can waste. Having a shower every day rather than once a week, whether you need it or not. Things like, you know, we did have a flush toilet in Utah, but one that works rather than one that you're constantly fighting with to make sure it doesn't get blocked. Coming from the Arctic, that was more of a depressurization because we left the station and we flew to this tiny little town of 200 people called Resolute Bay until the weather was right for us to fly down. Then we went to Yellowknife, which is a town of a few thousand people in the far north of Canada, still north of 60, though not the Arctic. But I do remember on the flight from Yellowknife down to San Francisco, flying over the Canadian prairie and just the human impact on the landscape. Instead of seeing just rock or around Yellowknife, endless forest, suddenly there's this immense checkerboard of fields. And suddenly what you're seeing is no longer the natural environment, but an environment that's been profoundly impacted in a positive way by human activity. And that was, humanity has changed this part of the planet almost unrecognizably. And seeing animals again, coming back and, seeing cats and dogs and all that sort of thing. And that was a very nice thing about coming back.
So we've done some practice missions on Earth. But I wanted to hear from John how close exactly he thinks we are to sending people to Mars.
If we put our minds to the society, we could be on Mars in 10 years. The technology we either have or we have prototypes for, it's just a matter of developing it. We know the people are tough enough and clever enough to be able to do it, and we know the sort of people who will do it. It's just a matter of the political will, of committing the resources to it. And the resources aren't that much. I mean, they're a lot for you and me, but compared to the amount of money that we spend on fighting wars of dubious value in various parts of the world, it's actually quite trivial. So it could be 10 years. I mean, it could take 100 years if we don't put our minds to it. But I think sooner or later, someone's going to try it. If it's not the US or Europe, it could be China or India or Japan in 50 years' time. So
you're the president of the Mars Society. Yeah. Do you reckon you'd get to go?
I'm the perfect age now. I'm in my 50s and it's interesting. People think of, young people in their 20s being astronauts, but actually people who go to Mars will be people in their 40s and 50s, people with long experience, lots of training, and perhaps even grandparents,
But how long does it take to get there?
6 months there. You spend probably 18 months on the surface and then 6 months home again. 2.5 years, wow. Which is the length of time that people spent going to the Antarctic in the classic era of exploration. Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton, they're all there for 2 years, 3 years, Mawson would be another one. The other thing to think about is it takes 6 months to get to Mars. The first fleet, when they came to Australia, took 8 months to get here. Mm. So Australia, 200 and something years ago, was Mars for people in Europe.
There's definitely some pushback, though, to the whole idea of humans colonizing, settling, mining, doing anything much in space.
The opposition comes not as popular mythology would have it from people with strong religious convictions. We shouldn't go into space because it's desecration. But it comes from people with a very strong environmental perspective that somehow by going to, that humanity is a disease. And people are quite adamant that we should stay here and fix our own problems and we shouldn't impoverish the Earth. There's some sort of perception that we're spending obscene amounts of money going to space when it is actually hastening our decline back into a new dark age from which there is no recovery. So it's a very strange and incoherent but very deeply felt passions that we should stay here and either fix our problems here or just not contaminate the rest of the universe. If we say, don't want to do it, that's not going to fix the problem. If we're concerned about something, let's go and play the game and make sure it's played right.
What is the picture of human nature that is going with this kind of pushback?
You could say it is a sense of total depravity, that humans are a blot on the landscape, they're a virus, their stars are better off without us. Of course, in the Christian worldview, we balance that with the fact that God is gracious, and not only gracious to those who have put their trust in him, but he's also gracious to those who have not. God sends his rain on the just and the unjust alike, as it says in the Bible. And we see in the world around us, you know, yes, there are great evils, but there's also great good that is done, often by Christians, often by non-Christians. And this is that common grace at work. When we go into space, yes, we take our problems, but we also take that grace with us. You think of the Apollo program, which was a very nationalistic program of beating the Americans, beating the Russians to the moon in terms of making a grand technological gesture. And yet that experience transformed itself. Because what did they do when they got there? In 1968, Christmas time, Apollo 8 circled the moon, and they read the first few verses of Genesis. The very first moon landing. Shortly after landing and everything was settled down, Buzz Aldrin said, I would like to take this moment to for everyone to reflect on what has happened and give thanks in his or her own way. And then he read to himself the passage from John about I am the vine and you are the branches, and took communion on the moon. Yeah, so no science fiction story, no futurist ever predicted that one of the very first things that people would do on the moon would be to take communion. But he did that.
Do you want to go to Mars?
I'd love to go to Mars.
Why?
I think there's many reasons. Some people go to Mars because it's the frontier. You know, some people want to go to Mars because maybe we can set up a new society there that avoids the errors of the old and make new mistakes and find, you know, create new ways of doing things. For me, I love beautiful places. And Mars has grandeur. It's got volcanoes with cliffs 8 kilometres high and canyons 12 kilometres deep. It's got blue sunsets and pink skies and great dust storms. It's an extraordinarily beautiful landscape, and I just love to be able to explore that in person. I love deserts. You know, my experience in the Arctic, I love the Arctic, being isolated, that sense of being away from everything and everyone, but still close to God. I mean, Psalm 139 says, wherever you go, God is there with you, even in your spacesuit. And I like that feeling. Historically, in many cultures, people have gone into the desert, into the wilderness to contemplate life, to come to a deeper understanding of themselves, of the nature of the universe. You know, philosophers, poets, the prophets have gone seeking the voice of God, scientists have gone studying the mysteries of the universe, and Mars is the ultimate desert in some respects.
From the Center for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Natasha Moore. Interested in science and faith? We have plenty more episodes of our podcast on this topic and a whole lot more. Just head to our website, publicchristianity.org, or subscribe to our podcast. Type Life and Faith in the search box of your podcast app to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do take a minute to leave us a rating or review. Let us know what you think of the program. It helps other people find our show too. Next week,
we found out on her second day of life that her life would be very short, very difficult, that there was no treatment, no cure, that this syndrome had already done a lot of damage to all of her major organs, especially her liver and her kidneys and her brain. So that, as you can imagine, was devastating news.